IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. My name is Arjun, and today we're going to talk about Afghanistan. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell you guys about an initiative that the Takshashila Institution has undertaken. It's called the Global Outlook Survey, and it is a survey meant for the ordinary citizen to gauge his or her opinion about Indian foreign policy. You can find the link to the survey in the description. So please do take it and help us out. Getting back to the episode. So it's been around 50 days since the Taliban has taken over Afghanistan. And the situation is still dire. And it's changing every single day. What about the humanitarian crisis? What about the internal factionalism within the Taliban? There are so many questions that need to be answered. And to answer it, we have our Afghanistan experts today. We have Shrey Khanna, who is a research associate with the Takshashila Institution, and Mr. Anand Arni, who is a distinguished fellow with the Takshashila Institution and has a background in intelligence and has worked extensively on neighborhood policies. So Shrey recently came out with a document which had the strategic assessment on Afghanistan and how it might impact the region. So Shrey, do you want to start off by giving us an overview and an intro to what the document contains?
Thanks, Arjun. Yes, I would like to talk about the recent report that I've produced for the Takshashila Institution. So in this report, I analyze the interest of regional powers, China, Iran, Pakistan, and Russia. In the context of Taliban's takeover, I also assess India's interest in Afghanistan and what are the likely options for New Delhi. My report argues that the Taliban victory in Afghanistan will impact the regional geopolitical dynamics, as you all know, and in the interest of regional powers. So one interesting thing is that during the insurgency phase, most regional powers had maintained a differential support to the Taliban to facilitate a common objective of the US withdrawal. But that common objective does not exist now, and that opens Afghanistan for a clash of regional powers, as well as the factional rivalries in a Taliban-dominated Afghanistan. They make it likely that the interest of regional powers would start diverging significantly. So, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So, the report anyways, we'll link that in the description too, so you guys can read it. So, let's go to Mr. Arni now. So, Mr. Arni, I just wanted to ask you about what you think the current situation in Afghanistan is, with especially Kabul under the control of the Haqqani network. And recently, Mullah Prather resurfaced after his absence, and especially the humanitarian situation. What do you think?
It's a bit of a mess there, really. The whole situation seems to be complex. It's not a simple answer that I can give you. There was a script, or at least everyone suspects there was a script that you laid down. The script was that the Taliban would come to the gates of Kabul. Ashraf Ghani would then be have peaceful handover, and Prather would come in, etc., etc. That script was never followed, really. Because a couple of things happened. One is, of course, that Ghani fled. For what purpose, we don't know. What reason? Maybe things were out of control. We don't really hear Ghani's story from the other side, from his side. So we don't know. We are just guessing. And before the Taliban could come in, or at least simultaneously, Haqqani network also walked in. A little later, perhaps, maybe a day later, they walked in. I'm differentiating here between the Haqqani and the Taliban. The Haqqani say that they're part of Taliban, but I'm not sure that is reciprocated from the other side. Having come in, there was this imbroglio. Nobody knew what to do with them. They took over certain parts of Kabul. They started exercising control in certain areas. And I believe the diplomatic quarter was under the control of the Taliban. So they'd come well prepared. They had their own, they'd done their homework, but things went literally out of control. And then came the issue, the fuss over the, or let me say, the confusion which came over an inclusive government. The interpretations of an inclusive government were different. Mr. Mullah Brother felt that inclusive government was pretty much what the script laid down, that is, bring in some people from the out from the Islamic Republic. And from what I gather, he even told a message was sent to the Islamic Republic people that, look, we just don't have the intellectual content to run any of this government. We want you guys to stay on. Which is also why a number of their leaders stayed back. Haqqani Network, on the other hand, saw no reason to go by this inclusive arrangement. And they had their own ideas of an inclusive arrangement. Even within the Taliban, within the political wing and the military wing, there are differences. The military wing felt that inclusivity meant bringing in their people who were from the north, but who were with them to create that inclusivity. There are too many fault lines in all of this. Then the fault lines are considerable because there is the Kandahari faction, there is the Kandaharis versus the non-Kandaharis, there is the Haqqani network with Taliban, there is the north versus the south, and there is Mullah Zakir of the military wing versus Brother of the political wing. All sorts of factions at this point. I think I'll come to this point and then we can probably take it stage by stage.
Thanks, Hussaini. That was really insightful. So I just want to know, you just mentioned about how there is already total factionalism with the Taliban. So I just wanted to ask you about what are these factional rivalries which is in the Taliban and what is actually occurring between Brother and Sirajuddin? And also, what is the role of the Haqqani network right now? Are they actually part of the Taliban? Are they actually outside the government? Are they acting on their own? Are they under the influence of the ISI? So what exactly is their role right now?
Well, in the ISI imposed settlement, Brother has been sidelined. And there have been reports of Brother and Brother's faction and Haqqani's faction fighting each other. But you know, Brother's downfall and the ISI control over the Taliban leadership, they run parallel to each other. So if we go back in history, so after the Quetta Shura came into being in 2003, it was composed of old Taliban members from Lower Kandahar. And then ISI struggled to control the Quetta Shura. So it established a new Shura, Peshawar Shura, to control Taliban activity in North and Northeast Afghanistan. And by this time, Taliban were regrouping 2005, 2006. So all those insurgents who were opposing the US, they started identifying themselves as the Taliban. Similarly, at this time, Haqqanis also launched their own Miran Shah Shura, which was also backed by the ISI. So as Brother was ruling, effectively ruling the Quetta Shura as Mullah Omar retired from the public eye. He was resisting the ISI attempts to integrate Miran Shah and Peshawar Shura's leadership within the Quetta Shura on the terms demanded by ISI. And he was also, by 2008, 2009, he was attempting conciliation with the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, which ISI did not support at that point. So in 2010, ISI decided to arrest him, and he was arrested in a joint CIA-ISI operation. So only after he was removed from the scene that the ISI could exercise dominance over the Quetta Shura, because at this point, even Mullah Omar was suffering from a brain tumor. He died in 2012. By some accounts, he died in 2011. So it's in the aftermath of his arrest that the integration of Haqqani network in Quetta Shura leadership occurred. And Sirajuddin now occupies a central role in Quetta Shura leadership. By the time Brother was released from Pakistan on the US order, Sirajuddin had cemented his role. So in this context, if you see Sirajuddin or Haqqani network, it is part of the Taliban, but it is also different from it as well. Because if you see the group, the Haqqani network, it has maintained training camps and safe havens for foreign jihadis since the Afghan jihad. And these groups are essentially in North Waziristan and Pakistan. So in fact, some of the earliest Deobandi Talibs were produced not in southern Afghanistan, where the Taliban movement started, but in Darul Ulum Haqqaniya in Akhora Khattar, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. So it is from that madarsa that the earlier Talibs were produced. So this is what distinguishes Haqqani's faction from the other Taliban faction, that their ability to maintain a stronghold in the areas traversing Durand Line, obviously with support from Pakistan, it makes their network or tribal militia different from other factions of the Taliban, which are based primarily in Afghanistan. But I want to point out one important issue involved here is that Haqqani's success in it's also a result of segmentation of local, regional, or global interest groups. And these interest groups do not always align with each other, but Haqqanis can support all each of them. So, for example, they have a record of using the TTP militants among their fighting rank. They also do the dirty work for the ISI, being a quote-unquote veritable arm of the ISI. And they're also closely dealing with global jihadi entities like Al-Qaeda. So it was in the camps hosted by Jalaluddin Haqqani that Al-Qaeda came into being. So even if you see ISIS, senior Haqqani commander Atiqullah Haqqani, he fought alongside Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And Sirajuddin, who heads the network now, he has seemed to have supported the rise of ISK in opposition to Mullah Hibatullah. So they have a kind of a nexus position because of the geography that they occupy. But that nexus position, I believe, emerged because they were ready to subordinate themselves to the Taliban before 9/11 or during Afghan Jihad, Hizb-e-Islami Khalis faction. So they subordinated willingly to these factions. But what has changed with the Taliban victory in Afghanistan is the fact that they now control Kabul and have widely taken centrality. So there is a clear change from Jalaluddin Haqqani's times and now under Sirajuddin Haqqani, who seems more attuned to take center stage. But this also, I believe, disturbs the previously existed balance. The center stage of Haqqani network is not likely to be palatable for long, either to the Loy Kandahar group of Taliban or regional powers like Iran and by extension Russia as well. So yes, they've sidelined Baradar for now and undermined Tehran as well. But Haqqani control of Kabul opens up a lot of intra-Taliban points of conflict. Just if I were to point out this detail that the, for instance, Sirajuddin and his family, and they belong to Karlanri Pashtun Confederacy, which is one of the four Pashtun confederacies. And they are essentially highland Pashtuns who are living in eastern Afghanistan and Fata regions of Pakistan. And they differ from the lowlanders, the Kandhari and the Helmandi Pashtuns, who belong to Durrani Confederacy and other confederacies as well. But they have a different lifestyle and values akin to the people of the plains, unlike the highlanders who are hilly, who live in this hilly, uncultivated region. So this sense of geography is important to understand the historical predominance of Durrani Pashtuns in Afghanistan. But now that has been, you know, taken away by the ISI intervention, and now Sirajuddin occupies such an important place in Kabul. But that also makes him a likely target of opposition if it emerges in between the Taliban.
Wow, that was a very insightful answer. I mean, there are so many players right now in Afghanistan, it's just hard to keep track of everyone. So next, I just want to ask Mr. Arni about, what are the prospects of the Islamic State of Khorasan re-emerging in Afghanistan? And this we saw during the attack on the Kabul airport, right? What is the role of Pakistan in propping up the ISK? Is it like a counterforce to keep the Taliban in check, or is it just to further their interests? So I just wanted to know about that.
Okay, yes, the ISK originally came up in Afghanistan, in Pakistan in 2014 in Waziristan area. And then that was when they were taking on the Pakistan army. And then because of the army operations in that area, they had to cross over to Afghanistan, where they established themselves and then swore allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Whatever the connections, whatever this they may say on the in the context of allegiance, the command and control of Syria or this thing is very tenuous. There is no link actually. Even the ideology is largely diffused. Of course, the one bit is that the base ideology of the ISK is a caliphate, whereas the Taliban is more for an Islamic emirate. So there is a clash, there is a difference there. A Khilafat gives you transnational geography, I mean, you can go into territory, whereas the Islamic emirate restricts you to Afghanistan itself. Originally, as I said, it came up with the TTP remnants having joined, come across to the ISK and joined on, and become the ISK. These were the guys who were chased out of Afghanistan, Pakistan by the army. Alongside came some minor bits, pieces of the Taliban who had differences with the then post-Mullah Omar leadership, later differences with them over the peace accord. But of course, a whole swath of foreign militants also joined hands. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, the Harkat-ul Islam of Tajikistan, then you had the Uyghurs, they came on board. A lot of small groups, stragglers from the ISIS who had come across here, stragglers, there were reports of a few Sudanese also being there, some Pakistanis, people like that. They had all joined hands and formed what is the ISK. ISK began aggressively taking over parts of Kandahar. They drove the Taliban out of there. And I suspect that the Pakistanis rang some alarm bells, and the Americans and the Taliban and the Afghan forces took on the ISK, and they were virtually routed in Kandahar. And of course, pockets remained all over. They desperately wanted sanctuaries at the sanctuaries that they had was running short. So they went across, strangely, went across to the ISI. That's what we understand. And ISI, in exchange for all giving them sanctuaries, secured two promises from them, that there'll be no operations in Pakistani soil, and two, they will accept Maulvi Aslam Farooqi as the leader. Well, Farooqi is an interesting character. Farooqi is not a Afghan. He's a Pashtun, but from we don't know really where he's from. Or some people say he's Afridi. Some people say he's from Orakzai. He's from that belt, Afridi, Orakzai, all the neighboring areas. And he had connections with the Lashkar. Lashkar is predominantly Punjabis, but there are a number of Pashtuns, Pathans. And he was one of them which was with the Lashkar. At some point, he went across to Syria and joined the ISIS with a group of about 150 or close to 200, between 150 and 200, went to join the jihad there. And they were there for about a year or two. Then they came back, and Aslam Farooqi became something to do with the ISIS in Pakistan. And then the ISI, he had also links with the ISI thanks to Lashkar connections. Pushed him into the ISK. He became the head of the ISK, as I said, in exchange for sanctuaries and also some funding which gave him. The original construct of the ISK resisted this. As I understand, there was a split, a major cleavage. The foreign elements of the ISK, that is the Uyghurs, those from Uzbekistan, those from Tajikistan, and the other Russian speakers who had all come, joined or proposed the name of a chap called Muawiyah Khorasani. Muawiyah is interesting. He's in his 30s. He is a Tajik. People say he's an Uzbek, but I think the Hornish certainly is from Tajikistan. He had gone across to Pakistan in his 20s and gone to Madrasa, where he was radicalized. And then he joined the movement. This is the name proposed by them. I would loosely call them the IS. One is ISK Farooqi, if you call them, and the other would be ISKM Muawiyah. Muawiyah's real name is Sharif or something like that. They moved off into the area near in Badakhshan, in the district of Jhelum, near the Wakhan corridor area, which is predominantly Uyghur or Tajik and Uzbek area, where the foreign militants are based. And Aslam Farooqi came to head the other faction, which is probably the larger faction of the ISK. And the heyday, there were about 8,000 ISK Farooqi's group, but they lost a lot thanks to the American and the Afghan operations. It was only a fact fraction of it. Some people put it at 10%, some people four. And there have been a number of operations have been attributed, which have taken place in Kandahar, in Kabul, have been attributed to the ISK. I find that a little dodgy, that sort of an explanation, because the ISK construct, which is with the thing, is predominantly Pakistani, with a few, with some Afghans. When Aslam Faruqi joined them, more from Pakistan joined them. The Afghan intelligence, in one of their reports, referred to them as Punjabis, which means Lashkar. And they took over. They came and there were operations in Kabul, which is really beyond the sophistication because they don't have the infrastructure there or the equipment or the, you know, bomber, suicide bombers. How do you move a suicide bomber from their areas into Kabul and keep him motivated? It's all right. Motivation is okay for 24 hours or 48 hours, but keeping him motivated for long enough to infiltrate into Kabul and then wait for the morning to go and launch a suicide attack is a little difficult to understand. And more importantly, coming to the present, is that more importantly, none of the operations that the ISK has done, has undertaken, has been against Haqqani network targets. It's been largely against Kabul, the armed forces in Kabul, the Kabul government, and the Taliban. There have been more major battles with them and the Taliban. And it doesn't require a crystal ball to say that there is, that both sides are preparing for a major encounter. That is the ISK and the Taliban. I think there was one fight already. There have been raids at Kabul. And the Taliban, the Haqqani network, is going to use the same tactics that we've used successfully in the past. It's going to be asymmetric battle. Let's see what happens. Last point before I hand it back to you is to say that the airport attack is bizarre. I mean, it doesn't really fit into my thing. It was in an area which was the Haqqani's controlled. There were checks along the way. The ISK did not claim responsibility for it. And then you have this major explosion which happened. And I'm not even sure if it was a suicide bomb, but we don't know. It could be a bomb placed in that area. To my mind, and this is all guesswork at this point, it was a message from the Haqqani network attributed to the ISK. And the thing was definitely attributed to the ISK. But it was a message from the Haqqani network to say that, look, we are in control. You ignore us at your peril. And then, of course, we have had this co-sharing arrangement between them and the Taliban, the governments of Kabul, Afghanistan. I'll just cut to the Haqqanis now. The Haqqanis have been, the Pakis have been selling it that the Haqqanis are, it is no longer Sirajuddin who he calls us out. It is Anas. And to that extent, it's Anas is much more visible. The only photograph of Sirajuddin was with his back to the camera as the interior minister. He's met a couple of people. It's not that he's not visible, but it's more Anas who has got it. I think it's largely because Sirajuddin, there's an odium about Sirajuddin. He's on the American list of wanted, etc. Anas has always been looked at as a non-militant type, and he has been brought in. It is an ISI attempted takeover of the whole structure. How long it will last is another question that we'll come to at a later stage, but let me give it back to you.
That's so interesting. Yeah, that was something that no one had ever thought about. Before we move on, I'd just like to take a break, and we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back. We're discussing Afghanistan and the prospects of Afghanistan in this episode. So the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has kind of thrown the region into sort of a peril. And there are neighbors who might be interested in the events which are happening in Afghanistan. So Shrey, I wanted to ask you, what is the emerging Iran-Pakistan rivalry? Is there a rivalry? What are their interests in Afghanistan and what can we expect?
So Iran-Pakistan rivalry in Afghanistan is nothing new. At least since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, their interests have conflicted, especially in Iran's interest, which it sees the province of Herat and Helmand, the western Afghanistan, as its zone of influence. This interest has conflicted with Pakistan's policy to gain strategic depth in Kabul. So, for example, during the Afghan Jihad, the Revolutionary Guards trained and funded Shia militias as a countervailing force against the ISI-backed Mujahideen. Similarly, after Taliban overthrew Iran-backed government of President Rabbani in 1996, Iran supported the Northern Alliance along with India and Russia. So, to counter Taliban, this changed after the US invasion in 2001 when IRGC had helped the CIA against the Taliban. But as the US-Iran relationship deteriorated, this led to IRGC's support for the anti-US insurgency. So after 2005, Iran started supporting a section of Taliban, which was operating in Western Afghanistan. It also started hosting a liaison office in Mashhad between IRGC and Taliban in 2007. So, and this office declared its autonomy from Quetta Shura in 2014. Later it came in line. But Iran also cultivated close relationships with senior Taliban commanders like Abdul Qayyum Zakir, the Guantanamo returnee, and Sardar Ibrahim. These both have taken senior positions in Taliban's military commission in the past. And these were disalienated from the ISI. They started acting contrary to the ISI interest in Afghanistan. So essentially, Iran's political investments in the Taliban movement were aimed at the future of the post-US Afghanistan. By acknowledging the Taliban as part of the solution, Iran sought to secure its influence in the post-US Afghanistan. Also, rise of ISK became an important factor in IRGC collaboration with the Taliban. So this became evident after the Taliban victory, when Iran did not have to close its embassy in Afghanistan because it had an understanding. Iran also helped Taliban's campaign in Western Afghanistan in securing alliance for Taliban and allowing its allies, its regional allies, to not oppose the Taliban. Also, we saw Iran agreed to resume the export of fuel to Afghanistan at the time. But the problems with Iran's approach, they have become evident, especially after the ISI chief's visit on September 5th. So as the reports of ISI chief intervention against the resistance in Panjshir Valley, they started coming. There were protests in Iran and there was slow generating death to Pakistan, death to Taliban in front of Pakistan's embassy. So next day there was a state-backed Tehran Times. There was an article in it. It called for drawing red lines in Afghanistan. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman praised the resistance forces for their martyrdom and warned against a foreign meddling in Panjshir. Then another setback Iran suffered when Taliban announced its interim government on September 7. There was absence of Persian, Dari-speaking minority groups from the government and exclusion of senior IRGC-backed commanders from leadership role. This all aggravated Iranian concern, and this started coming out from Iran's side. But ultimately, in some sense, Iranian pressure seems to have worked, because on September 21, Taliban announced the expansion of their interim government. And in that expanded government, we see IRGC-backed commander like Abdul Zakir, Ibrahim Sadr. They were given the post of deputy ministers in defense and interior portfolios. Also, an ethnic Hazara was selected as deputy minister of health. So after the expansion of the interim government, Iran also, for example, sent 3 humanitarian shipments in a week. So it tried to give incentive to the Taliban. But Iran's concerns, they are there because, importantly, the dominance of the anti-Shia Haqqani network in Kabul, the re-emergence of ISK, which many in Iran see as joint Saudi-Pakistan project. So there is an ongoing clash of Iran's Pakistan's zone of influence in Afghanistan. And then there is ongoing Shia-Sunni tensions, the sectarian tensions inside Pakistan. And Shias are increasingly becoming the targets of deadly blasphemy allegations, the cross-border killings on Iran-Pakistan border, they continue. So it has both Iran-Pakistan dimension outside of Afghanistan, as well as in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, we see this rivalry clearly playing out in the long term. It's like a long-term rivalry, which is going to play out in Afghanistan.
Interesting. So that was really insightful. Thank you, Shrey. So I just want to finally end the episode by asking Mr. Rani about what are the prospects of anti-Taliban resistance still prevailing in Afghanistan? Is there any anti-Taliban resistance? We heard stories about the Panjshir Valley falling to the Taliban and there is no more resistance to the Taliban. And also about India, of course. Should India support the Taliban and whether we should engage with the anti-ISI sections who are part of the interim government?
That's two questions. Let me first take on the opposition and then come to India and its policy. Yeah, Panjshir has fallen to the Taliban. But then again, remember that it fell 9 times to the Soviets. The Soviets were equipped with air power. Food and fuel was not a problem. This time around, the Taliban do not have fuel, do not have air support, maybe some drones, limited small drones. But nothing more than that, and food also could become a problem. For the moment, the Panjsheris have withdrawn to the hills, which is what they did the last 9 times. And then they came back when you can't keep a force for very long in that area. If you can guess it, about around 10,000 Panjsheris have taken arms and they're in the hills. You need a force of what? Minimum 40 to 50,000 to quell them. How are you going to keep 50,000 people in that narrow valley would be difficult. Food is going to be a problem. Eventually, if not today, someday they'll have to start thinning out and pulling out, and that's where they'll come back. That's how the Panjsheris will come back. This is a Panjsheri tactic which has been tried and tested, and it's worked in the past. So I'm not saying that it's not going to work. I'm not saying it's going to work. It's just that this is one of the important tools. The battle is not yet over. It will take some time. Other bits said that, yes, there is some friction in the most of the warlords that we can think of who have comprised the Northern Alliance. So that's our canvas, actually. There are a number of warlords in the South, but the South is still now at the control. If there is any resistance, it will be in the North. The warlords there are chafing. They have been sided. The Taliban has not co-opted the warlords into governance. Right or wrong, the warlords give you some element of governance in their area, and you really ignore them at your peril, to your peril. So you have Dostum and his, or the Tajik forces there. Dostum is maybe temporarily in Turkey, but he is quite an emotive figure. He can galvanize the people, carry a lot of charisma, a lot of fighting skills. Maybe he's getting old. Maybe he has gone past his send-by date, but he is charismatic. And he's got a second-rung leadership, which is fairly active. Now, where they have disappeared, what does more? Likewise, Ustad Atta, who is sitting somewhere in Uzbekistan, he too had a formidable force, one group of the Jamaat-e-Islami, which was centered around Mazar-e-Sharif. He's sitting in Uzbekistan, but his forces are there and they have armed. They're all at the moment quiet and there's no activity there because there is no financial support and there is no backup support coming from anywhere. Similarly, I'm just giving you figures. I don't know how this is going to work. It's there. Is Ismail Khan in Herat who was prepared to take up arms against the Taliban. He did signal that he wanted and then they gave him some pitiful. I think the Ghani government gave him peanuts and expected him to fight. That didn't work. So Iran offered him sanctuary. He's gone over. He sort of surrendered to the Taliban. And then he's now sitting in Peshawar. Then you have the Hazaras are there. Muhakkik with his forces. Muhakkik at the best of times had probably about 1,500. Maybe he's got much less. But they are armed and they've disappeared into the countryside. They're there. that Khalili's forces are also there in southern Hazara Jat. And the most formidable force is really the brigade. They have not been tested in battle in Afghanistan, but they are veterans from the war in Syria. They were recruited by the Shias and by the Iranians and sent to Syria. So they have come back with some amount of training, probably with their arms, and they've gone back and sort of merged with the local populace. I suppose you could galvanize, you could really give them a call and they'll come up. What I'm getting at is it's not really entirely finished as yet. The Taliban is thinly spread in the north. There's a report I was reading that when they took Sher Khan Bandar, they took it with a microscopic, it's a very small group, and most of the Afghans fled to Tajikistan. Holding places with 5 to 7 people, that's what the report said. So this can't work really. Then there is also anger brewing about the presence of Lashkar-e-Toyba people in that area. So all this is there. It's on this canvas there is problem areas. For example, for certain amount of work has been outsourced by the Taliban. Road holding activity in certain areas in that Chaman area has been given to the Mesuds, who are a Pakistani tribe. They're doing the Chowkidari job in a way. So you have these type of situation. Then most of the force is concentrated now in Kabul and in Kandahar. And do remember that Kabul is not a Pashtun town. It's a Pashtun force holding a town which is 25% Hazara, 45% Tajik. It's the Pashtuns are only 25%. So it's there. It's going to be uneasy. It's not going to really work. It's going to take some time for them to consolidate, and things are not really going well for them. There's no money. Electricity will probably drive, you won't have electricity in the next couple of weeks. That's a winter for you. The banking systems have collapsed. The Pakistani rupee is more being used as a currency for trading. There is no intellectual depth to run any of the offices or understand how finance and modern day banking works. Eventually, you'll see an outflow of doctors and nurses, and then with the pandemic on your hands, of course, it could get worse. That's on that front. And coming to India, I don't know. I can't give you any. I think I know that we did. There were some overtures made to Stanaksai, and there has been some contact between Stanaksai and the government of India in Doha. Earlier, before that, it was a rumored meeting which took place. Then it was more out in the open when Stanaksai went across to the Indian embassy for a discussion. But that Stanaksai is based at Kabul, based in Doha. He is supposed to be part of the Doha political office. Maybe he is, but I don't know. The Taliban 1.0 was not a great experience for him. He was there as deputy foreign minister, and then the Taliban replaced him, and he was jobless for a couple of months, and then he became deputy health minister or something like that. And his links are always said to be closer to the ISI than anybody else, so that's Stanaksai. Lastly, I will say this, that if you are going to say that of the options, the brother option is the best possible for the international world, and then the fact is that the only card that you really have today in the entire world is the recognition, the humanitarian assistance. And of course, a humanitarian assistance, I think, will come through in any case, even with or without, may not be in large quantities, but there will be triplets coming. The world will rise to the occasion. But recognition is a factor. The day you decide to recognize the Taliban as a force in Kabul is the beginning of the end for brother. The once recognition is there, the Haqqanis will push the Taliban out. It will then be a total takeover by Pakistan. That is something I'm not sure we want. I'm not privy to any of Khalili's decision-making, so I can't really say. These are my only inputs I have in this context. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Rani. That was really cool to listen to. So there's so much happening in Afghanistan, and the last 50 days have been like such a roller coaster ride, and we do not know what is going to happen next, and we could just keep an lookout for it. Please do read the document which we have come out, which has come out from our organization on Afghanistan. It will be in the description. So see you again. Thank you. Thank you all for listening in.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.